very, very hard to force things. All have children married, so. God doesn't want to be mysterious.
Our children raised them, they did marry them.
Okay, we're going to let Madeline ask.
All right, I'm going to take over now. It's Madeline Tauberg interviewing at this point. We're at the second half of tape one. Did you find it difficult when you first moved to Punxsutawney as a wife and to raise the children there after having been a Pittsburgh resident all your life?
No, it was not difficult because, first of all, it was a very wonderful place to raise children. And also, my husband and I traveled a great deal, and our children were born in Pittsburgh at Allegheny General Hospital, and we continued to use Pittsburgh doctors. My parents were still living at that time in Pittsburgh. And so I don't think that it was difficult. I think it was a very good place to raise children. Mm-hmm. I think we always had help, and I always had someone to leave them with.
So you had a very active social life, you're saying?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And this was not
both
a sacrifice.
In the city and out.
Probably I accomplished more in a small town than I might have ever accomplished in a city. Although I find myself, now that I'm back in Pittsburgh, I seem to be doing the same things. Immediately I find that I'm on something called the Downtown Neighborhood Association. I have gone to council meetings to fight for the library. I find that nothing really changes. I think maybe it's more so.
Did you find much anti-Semitism when you lived in Punxsutawney?
No, because I didn't look for it, and we always had friends. I always had lived in ecumenical neighborhoods, I suppose. When I think back to Farragut Street, there were very few Jewish families. I think that in school there would I would possibly be the only one in a class. I don't know that it was any different. We have always had friends of every race and religion. And so, if there were any, I didn't look for it, I didn't find it.
When you married after the war, after World War II.
Yes.
So, during the World War, you were writing stories for the Associated Press. Is that what you used to
talk? Well, I was writing from 1944 to 1950.
You must have had a lot of interesting experiences with that.
Well, it was
Tell us a few. It was
fascinating because, as a reporter for the Associated, as an editor, I should say, as we were all called, although we were reporters, of course, I covered everything. And, of course, this made me infinitely superior, at least I thought I was superior, to any other women who worked on Pittsburgh newspapers, because at that time there were three Pittsburgh newspapers, and each had one token woman reporter who was always referred to as a sob sister, which meant that she, in those days at least, she wrote about the servicemen's wives or this sort of thing. The other women were kind of segregated into a woman's department. Of course, later, I thought they really had the best of it because in those days, you could get all kinds of freebies. The papers had not become holier than thou, and they didn't really have standards of ethics, I suppose. So at Christmas time, everybody got gifts, except I didn't get anything because I worked for the Associated Press. But I covered coal strikes and steel strikes. I covered presidents when they came to town. I went to presidential press conferences. I spent an awful lot of time in the coal fields because those were the days of John L. Lewis and famous lines, no contract, no work. I used to feel in many ways I was here during the period of the great steel strikes that followed the war. I covered murder trials. I covered baseball and I covered football because I had been sports editor of the Pitt News. I knew Clark Shaughnessy very well, and one of the greatest coups I had was one snowy night when I got word that he had left or was leaving Pitt, and nobody could reach him, and I got a phone call saying, are you there, wait for me, and I walked past all the Post-Gazette reporters, and they said, do you know where Clark Shaughnessy is? And I said, no, which was the truth. Of course, he happened to be downstairs in the lobby of their building waiting to give me a scoop, I suppose, on why he was leaving and answering my questions. I would have to say that Jack Sell and some of those on the Post-Gazette didn't speak to me for a long, long time. But it did give me entree to things. I also remember when Pitt was going to name Wesley Fessler as one of their succeeding football coaches, and I had a very good friend in Dr. Carlson, who was then the Pitt basketball coach, and he ran into a friend of mine in the elevator, and he said, does your friend know that Pitt's going to name a new coach today? So she called me. I immediately raced over to Pitt, and he said, I can't tell you anything, and he tried to give me clues. And he was trying to tell me about some Methodist movement. I didn't know what he was talking about. How would I know about a Methodist movement? But then I finally had to write the name out, which still didn't mean anything to me. But he said, you know, when you see a best friend on campus and he doesn't speak to you, you know there's something going on. And so, of course, there again, we had the scoop on this man, that would be Wesley Fessler, who did turn out to be one of the best football coaches Pitt had in the post-Shaughnessy years. But in any event, there was lots of fun like that. And then there was the famous night of the first baseball strike, which was the, I say that was the end of my sports writing career. Because up to then, although no women were admitted to the press box at Forbes Field, silly things in those days, no women were admitted, they were kind of good to me and they let me up. They tolerated me. This is the thing, if you didn't step on anybody's toes, you were tolerated. So I was tolerated, and along came a man named Robert Murphy from Boston, who was the head of the Baseball Players Union. And none of the, in those days, and possibly still now up to a point, the baseball writers were all literally members of the team. Their expenses were paid by the team, they were expected to be cheerleaders for the team, and only incidentally were they reporters, but I wasn't paid by the team, and I wasn't assigned to the team. I was by the Associated Press. I was supposed to cover a story, and the story was what was going to happen. It was a New York Giants game at Forbes Field, and were they going to go on strike that night? So, all of the papers, the New York Times sent in special reporters from the city desk because these baseball writers simply couldn't handle a news story. And the Philadelphia Inquirer sent in a reporter, and I went for the AP. So the Philadelphia Inquirer man and I decided that we would interview the man of the hour, who was Robert Murphy. But we committed the unforgivable, since I was admitted to all these sacred precincts, which were not the press box itself, but they had set a little room aside where you could get free sandwiches and cokes and whatever it was. Didn't serve beer in those days, I don't think. So I, this man from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I took Robert Murphy into this sanctum sanctorum where they got a free sandwich and interviewed him, never thinking that this belonged to the ball club. So the next thing I know, I guess they didn't say anything to me then, but the next day, the game started, and there was one little telephone up there. And the question was, would they go out in the field or would they not? They went out in the field, and I tied up the telephone. So I got the story, but afterward I was told I was never again welcome there. And you know that it soured me. I think up to then maybe I'd kind of worshipped my peers, the male sports writers. I never had any interest in covering sports after that. First of all, I felt I had achieved what I wanted. I had proven that I could do a better job than any one of them.
And, they were envious of you, obviously.
And as a result, mm-hmm. I never had the slightest interest in ever fighting them again. And it was a very interesting experience. And of course, it wasn't too long after that, I think, that I left the AP anyway. One of my last assignments, though, was, I think that last week was very interesting. I covered a Detroit Lion Pittsburgh Steeler football game at the stadium. I had to do a play-by-play for the Detroit newspaper.
Where were they playing?
They played at Forbes Field.
At Forbes Field.
And I covered the farewell concert of Toscanini at the Sirium Mosque.
Oh, really?
And I covered a hearing at the federal building for a railroad engineer where there had been a terrible train wreck, and the train had been going too fast. And it's nice because I did get it. I don't know why I'm bragging so much, but I did get an AP citation for that.
Yeah, we
so
want to
forgive
know.
Me for this. I think.
No, we want to know all these wonderful
I'm just remembering things that I totally forgotten. Yeah, that's all.
So you went out with a bang.
Yeah, I really did. In fact, I've often said that the nicest compliment that was paid to me was by my then boss, Joe Snyder, who asked me if I would consider taking a leave of absence instead of resigning. And I said, well, first of all, I was going to live in Punxsutawney, and secondly, it was no way to begin a marriage to say, if it doesn't work, I'll come back. But they didn't hire another woman for many years afterwards, so I don't know whether I was that good or that bad, but whatever it was.
They probably couldn't get anyone who
It was a fantastic experience, and there again, but for the grace of God, a war, I would have never been able to work. I probably would never been able to get into a paper because they simply didn't hire women.
Uh-huh.
They certainly didn't hire women to write sports. They didn't hire women to...
So things have really changed to today's world.
Oh, yeah. You know, in some ways, you could say that I was born 50 years too soon or whatever it is. On the other hand, it was exciting and wonderful, and it's no different now. In fact, I think that I have one of my books in which I wrote a column for 7 years for the Punxsutawney Spirit, in which I took on all issues. It wasn't a cooking column, it wasn't a sports column, it was whatever was going on. And when I did not have anything to write about, then I would write about personal experiences. And at that point, one year, there was an article in the New Yorker magazine by so-called modern-day women sports writers giving their experiences. And as a result, I wrote mine. And as I said, that in many respects, nothing had really changed. They were treated just as badly today as they were then. Mm-hmm. And the only difference is that I was the only one, and I couldn't go into a dressing room, but I never missed a story. And I just think that it was wonderful to be alone, you know, doing something first. I don't know that there would be any great thrill in doing it now, but I think it was then.
That was your career with that ended when you moved to, married and moved
to
Punxsutawney.
And then I had one story, The Groundhog. So the cookbooks came out of a desire to make money for a very poor, struggling hospital and to tie it to a book. One of my wedding presents from a friend of my husband's who shot quail down there was a copy of the Charleston Junior League cookbook, which was based on Charleston low country cooking and on Charleston gullah and what have you.
Are you talking about Charleston, West Virginia,
Charleston,
or South Carolina?
South Carolina. And we went back a year later when he was doing some hunting there, and I picked up another copy of the Charleston Junior League cookbook, and I saw they had sold 100,000 copies. And I thought, well, if we could tie, I wasn't concerned about recipes or anything else, I thought, if we could tie a cookbook to the groundhog legend, we can sell this thing. And so I went to Kaufman's, because they had a very viable book department in those days, and I talked to a book buyer called Nan Houston, who was the assistant buyer then, and I asked her if they would carry the book if I saw one. She said, yes, they would carry it. Veronica Volpe, who was my friend, who at that time was food editor at the Post-Gazette, said she would edit it for me. There was a man named Bill Pratt, who wrote verse. He was in the PR department of Abercrombie & Fitch in New York. He said that he would write the doggerel for it, the little verses, because he did verse for New York and New Yorker, I mean, and for Gourmet and various magazines. He sold them. And he had a home, and he came from Punxsutawney. And so I asked Cy Hungerford, who had always been a friend of the Groundhog, if he would illustrate it for me. He said he would. And from there on in, we just went to town with it. And the title of the book at that time, M.F.K. Fisher, was a very famous writer, had written a book called How to Cook a Wolf, which was basically a Depression idea book. The wolf came to your door, you cooked it. I threw that title around and decided that was a little too literal. If you said how to cook a groundhog, this might really throw people off. So I took the title Cooking with the Groundhog, and I wrote the introduction and collected a committee. We really had no difficulty whatsoever. I mean, the recipes came together. And of course, Veronica did a great job on editing. She taught me all I know about editing cookbooks, and she could use a very sharp editing pen. In other words, because she was doing it, we didn't have to run 5 recipes for this or 10 recipes for the same thing. I mean, people were offended, they could be offended at her. So we were able to get a very tight editing job. We also, because I had a co-editor and because we both had traveled and knew a fair amount about food, we could be very selective. And we used recipes that at that time were very new. I mean, today they possibly are old hat, but you must realize that in 1959, when the first edition of Cooking with the Groundhog came out, quiche was barely known. I mean, the recipes that were in there, but even today, I mean, you can find a recipe for almost anything in that or the other books. And so she went to New York, and she called Craig Claiborne, who had just been appointed food editor of the New York Times. And he was very intrigued, and he said, she didn't have lunch with him, but I guess she went to see him. And meanwhile, we had some pictures taken. It was always the right time at the right place. We said to somebody at the beauty shop, do you know anybody who has a groundhog? I didn't know anything about groundhogs, really. And he says, does anybody have a tame groundhog? I didn't even know you could tame one, and frankly, you can't. But then, yeah, we know a family that has a groundhog. It turned out it was a town drunk, and he had about 11 children. And they lived way out in the country, and they had picked up these groundhogs when they're born, or about 2 inches long. And they pulled this baby, this little thing, out of the ground, and these 11 kids had thrown it around and raised it. And the father used to take it to the bar and throw it down in the bar, and they'd feed it little drops of port wine and what have you. Well, we called them, and that was fine. Meanwhile, through somebody or other, we made contact to get on the Today Show. I don't know how we did all this, but somehow we did it. Meanwhile, the New York Times went on a strike, and there was no New York Times for week after week after week. and we had sent the pictures and everything in November. And the week before Groundhog Day, they settled the strike. Otherwise, every single one of those editions would have been thrown out. And on Groundhog Day, there was Craig Claiborne's two-page spread in the new Sunday New York Times on Cooking with the Groundhog. So that was Cooking with the Groundhog. It made a good bit of money, all of which I regret to say was more or less thrown out when they decided to put two semi-private rooms on the tail end of a building that I knew was going to be condemned, and they knew it was going to be condemned, but anyway, it was done. So I broke with that, but 8 years later, because there still was a demand for the Groundhog story, 10 years later, meanwhile, I had been collecting the Groundhog cartoons that he had done since 1928, and I worked for about 8 years at the Carnegie Library getting them on microfilm to see what they were, because I felt we could do a definitive story on it. And my husband kept saying, you'll never do it, you'll never do it. And I said, well, when finally somebody tells me I'll never do something, that's when I do it. So finally I sat down and worked for like 3 hard months all by myself, did this one all alone, but it was was a better way to do it, and then handle the sale through charities and the like, which I find is the better way. So I did the book, and then I sent a copy to the New York Times. Craig Claiborne by then had left the Times, for he was no longer the food editor. And one day, about a week before Groundhog Day, I got a phone call at 9 o'clock in the morning. I didn't know what happened to the book, or I never got an answer. And the woman said, this is Jean Hewitt. I'm the food editor of the New York Times. I found this book in my drawer. I'm fascinated. Tell me about it. So I told her about the book, and I ran out, and I quick got some pictures taken. I located our dentist, had 3 cute kids, and I got hold of Sam, and I got hold of the stuffed groundhog. Ran out and got some pictures taken and sent a picture out to them. Which on the following Saturday there was an 8-column spread. You know, this is stuff that's incredible because it's fate. I mean, it isn't anything that you do. It isn't anything you could do. It is something that has written in the stars, I guess.
It was meant to be, and apparently your work was so good.
It was. It was there.
Where did all the recipes come from? From Punxsutawney people?
Well, some came from Punxsutawney people who had traveled and the like. Some came from friends. A lot came from us where we just kind of put the names in. But, I mean, there were recipes that we used or knew, and we had people who, I suppose, we associated with people who did reasonably good cooking, and we traveled a lot. There's never been any problem getting recipes. And I did the... I don't even know how I did it. My husband was very ill when I did the third edition. I mean, not the first one. I mean, when I did the one in 1968, which was when the first copy of Cooking with Gourmets and Groundhogs came out. And the reason for the title was that Gourmets was the food, but the Groundhogs was really the illustrated history in which I did the complete story as of that time. And then when it got to about 82, I mean, I had, every time the book was reprinted, I expanded, because I'm never content to leave things alone. And finally, in 82, I realized that somebody said it really wasn't worth buying a book for one or two new recipes. And I found out, too, in the course of doing all these books, that no matter what recipe you took out, it was always someone's favorite recipe. I always said if you had a recipe for poison, one of the Borgias would call you and say, where's that recipe? That's what I always used. It didn't matter how you might have thought that you were. I know that there was a recipe for yogurt soup, and finally I thought, well, no one really. It was a Turkish recipe, and I thought, no one really wants to make yogurt soup. And someone had called me, a cousin, and said, oh, you don't have a recipe for vichyssoise. I'd like a good vichyssoise. So I thought, well, you know, I'll just put in the good vichyssoise, and I'll just take out the yogurt soup. I got a letter from some woman in Philadelphia who was a cooking teacher, and she said, I can't find the recipe I always used. It was the recipe for yogurt soup. So I felt then that it was really very foolish to ever, ever change a recipe. So I wondered what to do with doing another edition. I realized that I couldn't keep 3 books going, and I thought maybe the thing to do was just kind of do a book within a book, and I decided to do something called The Second Helping, which would be separately indexed and really be kind of a new book, so that anybody who had the whole old book could... in clear conscience give it away or throw it out or whatever it was, because they would not only be getting a whole new book, but they'd be getting every edition that was ever printed in it beside. They would not lose any
recipes. And that was in 1982?
Yeah, it was 82. Mm-hmm. And that's the book that I have just given to the Easter Seal Society in Punxsutawney. I feel the book should be handled in Punxsutawney. I'm very happy to turn it over to them. I helped them with the printing, and I helped them with the publicity. And it works out fine.
When was your second book put out? What year was that?
Well, Cooking with the Groundhog, which is, I think, had 7 or 8 printings now, is, it's still being printed, but it was a hospital auxiliary project, and it came out in 1959.
Oh, and the second one in 68.
And then 68, 10 years later, the Gourmets and Groundhog series started. So it is now in its 5th printing, which would be the 5th, but each one has been a completely new edition. We made a few corrections for the new one, although really the introduction was very current, and we changed some of the pictures.
Let me ask you a question. Who did you say did the cartoons? Because they're wonderful.
Cy Hungerford.
Oh, that's right. Now I recall the name. Seeing it. Yes. Simply wonderful.
Yeah, they were the Hungerford cartoons.
Did you have any friends in Punxsutawney who helped you put this together? I mean, women friends.
Yeah, because I have they're all mentioned in the introduction.
I have the books, but I didn't know the names. Be careful.
I had very good friends.
Did taste your groundhog cookies, and did you devise that recipe yourself?
Yeah, I worked because we had to have something. People were always writing and say, what can we serve
on Groundhog Day?
And I worked for it took me, how long was it? I had a little article on it that I wrote about that too. How long it took me to convince somebody to make a groundhog cookie cutter, and then I tested about 11 recipes before I found the one that I liked and that I thought.
Did you say you made the form of the groundhog cookie cutter?
Well, I didn't make it, but I mean,
I mean, you devised it and something you had to make.
I took it to the, the manual training department or whatever they had then, and they came up with a prototype. Oh. And then we couldn't get anybody to make it. But eventually, I think, is this the Easter Seal edition? I'm trying to find the, there are two introductions.
No.
There are two introductions. There's one introduction to.
Did the people wear any special outfits, or was it just the president that wore the top
hat?
Not
in the beginning. It was all kind of a hodgepodge, and then my husband invented the kit because I asked him why, and that's in the introduction to explain it. Because in those days, New York City had an official greeter, who used to greet the ships that came in, the Duchess of Windsor and the like, and he always wore, this was a VIP outfit, the striped trousers and the like. And Sam decided the groundhog was very VIP, and from that they adopted the outfit.
Wonderful.
Oh, here. In collecting, testing, and appraising the recipes, I'm indebted to my friends with special thanks to Emma Lou Allen, Sandy Anderson, Diane Ball. These are all people who helped in set the recipes.
It's in your book.
Ellen Schildhaus was the book buyer at Horns, and she gave me great support. I don't have a book department anymore.
Horns does not have a book department. I wasn't aware of that. Kaufman still has retained theirs.
But they don't have it. It's B. Dalton. So.
Oh, they took it. Right.
Even then, I don't know how. I don't think you can ever sell a number of books again. I don't think you can do anything that we did during the course of those.
So as you look at things, life has changed drastically in many, many ways.
I don't think anything that I did could ever be done again in the same way. I mean, I think, now I'm not saying with the publicity, maybe you could do even more. Now, if this movie comes out and it creates whatever Punxsutawney thinks it's going to, Groundhog Day. It could be, they think, even though the movie was filmed, by the way, in Woodstock, Illinois, they finished the filming now. It's they recreated Punxsutawney quite literally in Woodstock, Illinois.
What is your position with this movie? You're going to be
I'm just not with the movie. I'm doing things for the Punxsutawney's paper. They're doing a book. I'm doing things for them. In fact, actually, I said to the editor, I wrote the whole thing, because what he did was take all the articles that I've written down through the many, many years of Punxy, and he's just recast them.
What I see about you is your extreme modesty of having accomplished so many, many things. What would you think was your greatest accomplishment? Because you have so many honors that you're not even talking about that I can see it's coming out in bits and pieces.
Well, I don't have honors, but in fact, it's kind of funny when I went back, when I gave them the cookbook, And they had a luncheon, and I really was stupid. I honestly didn't know the luncheon was for me. I mean, I thought the luncheon was to launch the cookbook, but I didn't know the luncheon was for me. And they had an autograph session, which they hadn't bothered to tell me about, and it was on a wintry day. I mean, and I had to leave. I had symphony tickets or something here in Pittsburgh, so I rushed it. But I really thought it was very funny, because the cookbook, when before it was reprinted, sold for $8.95. And then, of course, after it was reprinted, it had to match the price of the Three Rivers and the cookbooks in the same genre, so the price went to $12.95. I didn't know what they were going to sell it for in Punxsutawney, because that's none of my business. But anyway, apparently they were selling it for $12.95, and I thought it was really so funny, because I lived in Punxsutawney all those years, and anybody could have bought the book for $8.95. I did autograph books. I don't mean that people didn't want them autographed, but I did. But here were all these people coming that I never really had bought books before, and all of a sudden they were standing in line to have me autograph a book for $12.95. And I thought, you know, this is really crazy, because if I'd known I was going to be so well treated, I'd have left long before. I mean, it is absolutely true that a prophet is not without honor, saying it's a prophet. And I have people now, you know, telling me that this would be such and such and so and so if I were there, and so on and so forth. And I thought, well, it's really very nice to hear it, but it really is true that you are taken for granted when you're there, which is not the reason that I left. That had nothing to do with it. I mean, I must confess, in all honesty, that I never intended to spend my life in Punxsutawney. I am a city girl. I love the city. I come to life in the city. I like everything a city has to offer. I do not yearn for the country. I see lots of grass in the city. I enjoy certainly the scenery, and I enjoy all. I don't feel that small town life is.
Did you have a college there? Was it Penn State?
No, we had the branch of, that's what I was, the head of the College Trust. We have a branch of Indiana University.
Oh, okay.
And then
Indiana,
I worked to set up this culinary institute. I didn't leave Punxsutawney, in fact, until that project was finished. It kind of came up just about the time that I was kind of planning to leave. And once I was involved in it, I stayed until the building opened.
Do your daughters ever go up to Punxsutawney?
Yeah,
they
love Punxsutawney. Melanie has a particularly deep affection for it. I think Meredith does too. They've never quite forgiven me for leaving. I think maybe they're a little bit understanding, but I know that one incident right after my husband died, and I guess they were at a table when I said that I would be giving it up. Because we've had the apartment in Pittsburgh for a number of years. I took a small apartment at the Carlton House when my father was ill, and I really needed a place to stay. And then they took over all the studio apartments, so we took a one bedroom. And then they tore down the Carlton House, so we took a one bedroom here. Then when it went condominium a year later, I bought it, and then I was able to add another apartment to it. So I finally had enough space, at which point I could get rid of a 10-room house that I was not using much of. But I know that when I said that I would sell it, you know, the first outcry was, but Mother, these are our roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I know, but they're not my roots. My roots are in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, if anybody wants to live in this house, you can have it. And, of course, nobody wanted to live in the house. What they wanted was me to be in the house.
Sure.
So if they wanted to come home once every year or every 2 years, nothing would be changed. Everything would be the same.
Well, we're just about finished with this session,
yes,
but I would like to ask you, do you see much of a difference in the way you were raised to the way you raised your children, as far as what they could do and their permissiveness as against what you were allowed to do as a child? Because you came from a family of two and had two.
Yeah, you raise, well, of course, we were poor. I mean, we were really Depression children, and we definitely were poor relations. We lived with my mother's family, and I don't know that they bothered me, but I think they never let my father forget that we were poor relations, and I mean, I think that did bother me. But, you know, I did wonderful things because it didn't cost anything to do them, and I think, when I think that I went to the opera, don't ask me why, for 75 cents, I think, you could go, I saw Victoria Regina I remember having a last seat in the last row at the Nixon Theater for 75 cents. I could go to the movies for 15 cents or 11 cents or whatever it was. I could buy a bag of, you know, cherries, or I had a wonderful time deciding whether I wanted cherries or whatever. I would go through McCann's and look at all these wonderful things to spend a nickel. And I'm not at all sure. I could buy a dress. I think maybe dresses were $3.95. The best dress you could buy was, I think my graduation dress was $17.50. Mm-hmm. I think that we could do so much more then.
Mm-hmm.
And I could, you know, walk to the library in East Liberty. I think that we probably had, by all accounts, an underprivileged childhood. But I didn't feel that it was underprivileged. Mm-hmm. And we always had good food and lots of it. The only thing we didn't do, I think, was go on, we didn't go to vacations, so some of my richer friends could go to Chautauqua or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only thing, but since I don't like to swim and don't like to do anything, you see, never bothered me.
You didn't go to camp?
I went to Girl Scout camp and despised it.
Oh.
I don't like camp. I don't, you see, it suited me. Now, my children could do anything, I suppose. I don't think we spoiled them. I will say this, I think my greatest achievement was when Meredith wanted a car and she was able to buy a car at Syracuse for $400. Now, this is before double-digit inflation of about 72 or something. And we told her she could have the car if she would work to pay the insurance on it. And she worked as a waitress that summer, and she paid the insurance. You know, she learned something.
Indeed. Absolutely.
And we never, you know, we just never spoiled them in that
mm-hmm.
way.
Fantastic.
They always laughed because Sam was very generous in some ways, and in others it was just a joke. He would take them to the Dairy Queen, but they were never allowed to buy a sundae. I mean, he would let them have ice cream. It was crazy, but I mean, everybody has their own funny little thing. But
yeah.
But they're wonderful because they, and of course, I think one interesting thing, they adored their father. He was absolutely wonderful with children, and even though he was so much older, and I remember that I have a friend who apparently his age bothered her, didn't bother me, and Meredith stayed with her a little bit when she first went to New York after she graduated from Syracuse. She graduated with a degree in advertising design. And so this friend said to her, "How did you feel having a father that old?" And I think Meredith gave her the most beautiful.